This is Central Time. I'm Rob Verrett. Coming up, we'll talk to a fisheries biologist from the DNR about the start of muskie season here in Wisconsin and how the muskie population is doing around the state. Now, it's election season here in Wisconsin and around the country, with midterm primaries underway and the general election in November. Issues like the economy, education, and crime are big topics, as usual. But another big issue may be the future of democracy itself. Our next guest writes, there are growing threats to our system of elected government in the United States. She says power has become more consolidated, making minority rule possible, decreasing political competition. And she says political theater has become more dominant than substantive debate, which means real issues that affect voters aren't always talked about. I want to hear from you at 800-642-1234. Do you have some basic concerns about our system of government, our system of representative government in the United States? How about specific things like gerrymandering, the role of the Supreme Court, the U.S. Senate, the filibuster? Do those in particular worry you? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@WPR.org. Julia Azari is an associate professor of political science at Marquette University. Julia, welcome back to Central Time.
Thank you so much for having me.
Before we get into some of the specific concerns you raised in a recent piece, I just want to kind of get your temperature on this. You know, it's a normal election season in some ways. Candidates are talking about issues like they normally do. But there are people worried that there are fundamental threats to the future of this whole system of elections and democracy. How worried are you?
So I'm sort of in the middle, I think, in terms of where political scientists and other people who watch this stuff closely are. I think there are people who are really, really concerned. And one of the pieces that I reference, one of the ideas that I reference in the piece, is someone who's written kind of about the conditions of civil war and said that the United States looks like a place that's going to go into civil war. And I think everyone who follows politics can really relate to the idea that sometimes you see the temperature being turned just way up and it feels like no compromise can be had. On the other hand, though, I think, as I write in the piece, I think there are some reasons for hope, and that we're at this sort of moment right now that we could see as really a big crisis, or we could also see as a kind of important inflection point where we really, as a country, started paying attention to a lot of important issues and thinking about how we do this, how we work together as a country across lots of difference to really have self-government, to have government by the people in a way that includes everybody. So I think there's reason for hope. There's reason to think this country's quite resilient, but there's also a lot of things in our politics that are not consistent with what many of us, I think, grew up to expect from a democratic country and from our system.
Yeah, that's one of the core themes in your recent piece, that some of our institutions of government don't very well reflect popular opinion, popular sentiment in the United States. What kind of things do you have in mind?
A lot of things when I started to think about it, which is not great. If you're like me and you grew up in this country in the 1980s, in my case, and, you know, kind of learned that the core of democracy is we have checks and balances, but we do have a kind of sense that the people rule. And it's not that majority always rules, but that it sort of moves in that general direction. And that when governing institutions, when governing bodies do things that people don't like, that the people have some recourse. That's the sort of story of the American Revolution that I learned growing up. And what we see instead is, you know, a Senate that reflects a design that was done at a time when the state population differences were much smaller than they are now. So it's very unequal in terms of how many people each senator represents. We see, here in the state of Wisconsin, our state legislature set up in a way that it's just impossible for one of the two parties to win in a state that's very competitive and where in many offices, you know, it's normal to expect Democrats and Republicans to flip back and forth and share power, because that reflects the balance of opinion in our state. You see this with the power that the courts have, and the Supreme Court in particular. If no institution is really checking the court, they can basically do whatever they want. And I've been thinking about this for about a decade, about that kind of the ability of the court to rule on issues like campaign finance. Of course, everyone's thinking about abortion. It's possible we're going to get a ruling soon on gun control. you know, to rule in ways that are really out of step with how most Americans think. And that's not how I learned that was supposed to be.
Let's focus in on the Supreme Court for a little bit. A very solid conservative majority. There's an argument with the Supreme Court that, hey, it's not supposed to move with public sentiment and popular opinion. They're supposed to be preserving fundamental, foundational ideas of American government. How worried are you that they've swayed too far from public sentiment?
Yeah, I'm a bit worried about it. And I think no one really has the final authority on what the Supreme Court is supposed to do. The Article 3 in the Constitution that sets up the judicial branch is pretty sparse. Our notion of judicial review comes instead from kind of informal understandings that developed early on in the Republic. People point to different cases to establish that the court is supposed to kind of protect fundamental rights from this majority that wants to take them away. And I think we have to think really critically about what that actually means in practice, what it actually means to protect rights. And if by definition, if the court makes a decision, that doesn't mean that rights are being protected, right? That's, I think, the key response I would have to that is no one really has a monopoly on what it is the court is supposed to do. And if they were to play that role, if they were to play this sort of what we call in political science counter-majoritarian, kind of rolls off the tongue, if they were to play that role where they're protecting rights against a majority that wants to take them away, then that could be an important role. But it's also, it doesn't mean that they get to have a kind of unchecked ability to do that. It would mean that the other two branches are checking their power. And we don't really see that happening in a meaningful way in contemporary politics. So that's the other thing I think that sort of happened is the role of the Supreme Court has kind of evolved over time in politics.
How about dysfunction in another branch of government? People often point to Congress with inability or unwillingness to pass a lot of laws that I think people are hoping to see something happen on. Years of debate over immigration, for example. The government often works by a presidential executive order and court challenges to that order back and forth. Is there something in Congress that would help it step up and be a more equal branch of government, if I'm even right to say that it's dysfunctional in the first place?
Yeah, I mean, it's pretty slow. And again, we kind of get to this question of, like, how are these things supposed to operate? What was the original logic of the design? How does that logic compare with what's going on in our country now? And people, again, have been kind of talking about Congress. You know, there's this book called The Broken Branch that I think was first published in 2006. So we've been talking a lot about Congress in this regard. Immigration is a big focus there. There was a lot of talk amongst some students I was teaching last week about why gun control failed in 2013 after Sandy Hook, particularly some pretty middle of the road compromise measures that are quite popular with Americans. I mean, I think that one big thing there, you hear a lot about the filibuster, making the Senate by default a 60-vote body. Let me say this carefully. I think that if there were a possibility that 60-vote requirement meant that you did have to build big, broad compromises, get a lot of people on board, get a lot of different perspectives, come to a common ground between conservatives and liberals, if that 60-vote threshold were achieving that goal, then that could be a good thing. But instead, it just means nothing ever gets passed because people in the Senate and on many pieces of legislation, important, you know, high stakes legislation, are going to vote party lines. It's pretty unusual for one party to get 60 votes. So that's sort of my take on the filibuster.
Talking to Julia Azari from Marquette University about dysfunction in American government, threats to our system of representative government. You can join in at 800-642-1234. You also write that political spectacle has taken over more and more as opposed to substantive debate. What kind of things are you looking at?
Yeah, so I'm looking, I mean, let's be honest. I'm spending way too much of my time looking at Twitter. but, you know, I'm not alone. And I think that between social media, between cable, there's so many opportunities to sort of score political points, right? To make a video or do a tweet or both, or there's probably some other social media I'm not even thinking about. I don't know what goes on TikTok. I'm too old. But, you know, there's a lot of, I think, opportunities to kind of score political points or create some kind of spectacle, as opposed to tackling something that really actually matters and that people actually care about. And that's kind of the thing that I was thinking about as I was thinking about some of these issues, is that you'll see representatives, elected officials, or people seeking office kind of using their platform to score political points and talk about what the other side isn't doing, rather than, or to talk about these sort of explosive cultural issues, that some of which are not really, you know, issues that are on the public mind, rather than addressing the economy, which is almost always everyone's top priority, security, you know, war in Ukraine, there's any number of issues people are concerned about. Climate change, certainly is something I hear a lot about in my work with young people. So that is essentially what I meant by that.
Julia Azaria is with us, Associate Professor of Political Science at Marquette University. She's talking to us about the state of American democracy, possible threats to our system of representative government, possible solutions to those problems. You can join in at 800-642-1234. In this election year, do you feel like it's a normal election year? You're looking at the normal sorts of things you would watch for from a candidate, or do you have a bigger sense that something is at risk, that something is threatened here in the way we do representative democracy in the United States? Call it at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or email ideas@WPR.org. We'll pick up the conversation coming up on Central Time. This is Central Time. I'm Rob Verrett. We're picking up our talk with Julia Azari. She's an associate professor of political science at Marquette University. We're looking at the ways that American representative government may not be functioning well, maybe some possible fixes. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Let's go to your calls now. Richard is with us in Waukesha. Richard, hi.
Yeah, I'm concerned about the response to January 6th and how it seems sympathizers to the argument that Trump won the election have been getting elected and or appointed to positions which are going to control the election in 2024.
Richard, thanks for the call. Julia?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I think people are very concerned about that. And I think that, you know, one of the reasons that the 2020 election during some very tough conditions went down in terms of the counting of the votes as smoothly as it did is because there were Republicans and Democrats alike at the state and local level who are election officials who did their jobs. That, you know, those positions tend to be very low, you know, low attention kind of offices, and people who are sympathetic to kind of violent perspectives are I think in some cases are winning these primaries. The primaries are still going on. I think that's a big concern. And that's, I talk a little bit about that in the sort of the consolidation of power part of the article, about the ways in which some of what's going on in our country has tipped from like, okay, the two parties are always trying to jockey a little bit for an advantage, to, okay, there's a specific movement. And I think it's largely contained in one party, which is even more unfortunate. It's concentrated, that has, you know, decided to reject elections. And that's, everybody of every political persuasion should be really concerned about that. And we should, I think, all be invested in the integrity of our democracy. And then we can battle it out about the issues, of course, peacefully.
Richard, thanks for that call. Matt joins us now in Minocqua. Hi, Matt.
Hi, Mr. Zari. Just a quick shout out to you. My son graduated from Marquette about 4 years ago, and he sang your praises, said you're an amazing teacher and had a great experience in your class. So,
oh, wow.
That was for you. But yeah.
Thank you.
My question is, you know, to me, it seems like a no-brainer that term limits would be a solution to a lot of our problems. I know that, you know, there's people for and against. I'm just wondering what your opinion is for or against term limits, if that would, you know, solve a lot of the problems and the dysfunction in our government.
Matt, thanks for the call. We've got term limits for our presidents, Julia, but of course not for Congress. What do you think?
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. So term limits are probably the area where professional political scientists are the furthest away from mainstream public opinion. Political scientists tend to, I won't say we all hate term limits. So there's a range of opinion, but most people are skeptical. And the main reason for this, and there's some research on this, which I don't have in front of me, but the basic idea is when you have newcomers coming into Congress constantly, one of the things that they become more dependent on is kind of interest groups and lobbyists for more information. And so when you don't have experienced legislators, you become even more, the system becomes even more dominated by these organized and well-funded interests. That's one concern. Another concern, you kind of think about, like, well, what are the incentives of people in their last term? You know, what are they thinking about? If they're not interested in courting re-election, then what are they trying to do? And often people, I think, are suspicious that the answer is trying to get a job, again, at one of these well-paying lobbying firms. And, you know, I think there's a great book about term limits for presidents by a scholar named Michael Corzi, C-O-R-Z-I. I don't remember the name of the book, but it's something pretty straightforward that kind of talks about, it mostly talks about how they came to be, but a little bit, I think it's worth thinking about, like, has this been a good development for the presidency? Has it limited presidential power, which I think is somewhat of a seemingly contradictory answer, but it seems like no. On the plus side, I will say, of term limits, I do think there are some people in the scholarly profession who are kind of sympathetic to the problems with term limits, but on the other hand, it's like, okay, it's become absurd for people to serve in Congress for decades upon decades. That is, you know, really, I think, does violate a lot of people's sense of what democracy should be about, and does give a sense that folks are really insulated from, you know, from any real political pressure to do what their constituents want. They're just kind of there. They don't ever really face any true accountability. We can debate about that. Some people might say, well, if you like your representative, you should be able to keep voting for them if they're doing a good job. So I think there's really a live debate to be had about that. But I do think that there's widespread concern about members of Congress serving for these just, you know, enormous amounts of time.
Matt, thanks for calling in, talking to Julia Azari from Marquette University about potential threats to American representative government. One more point I wanted to get to in that piece we referenced. You're worried about the normalization of white supremacy in politics. Can you talk about that a little?
Yeah, I mean, I've spent a lot of time talking about that over the last couple of years. And I think that this, you know, one issue that I've sort of seen subtly creep up is more and more kind of extremist views becoming expressed in more mainstream ways. We have seen some of that. We have kind of seen, you know, what happened a couple months ago this is more fresh in my mind when I wrote the piece a while back. But some members of Congress, Republicans, had gone to a white supremacy conference. They were rebuked by Republican Party leadership, GOP leadership, distance themselves from that. But the way our parties are structured, they don't have a lot of control over it. So I'm very concerned about that. I'm also concerned about the ways in which there's kind of everyday racism that seeps into politics and in both parties. I wrote a little bit about this and about some research that suggests, you know, Democrats also will kind of distance themselves from the concerns of African-American and other non-white citizens when they feel like it's politically advantageous, and that's often the case. So I think this is something where I don't think this is playing out the same way in the two parties. I know that's not what some people want to hear, but that's what I think. But yet at the same time, I think that there is, the party system doesn't do a great job championing the concerns of communities of color, and our history means that those concerns do need to be addressed through the political system. That's, I guess, how I would phrase that.
Julia, just a couple minutes left, and I think I've biased our conversation more on the threat side and less on the hope side. Talk a little more about the hopes you have to overcome some of these problems.
Yeah, so I have a couple of hopes in terms of thinking about where we're at and where we've been. One is that I think part of it is there are a lot of people invested in the stability of this country. We have a really robust what I describe in the piece as civil society, of organizations, of private businesses and industry. A lot of organized ways in which people operate in our society. And it's fairly rare, I think, to see an authoritarian takeover when you have such a robust civil society and so many people who are invested in our country continuing to operate. I also think these are often, like I said, when you look back in history, these moments of great tension and conflict are really the moments where you see, like, this is where things change. This is where things get better for groups that have historically been left out of the conversation or been kept out of opportunities because of who they are. This is how change occurs. And it also seems like we actually do have some agreement on some of the major issues, maybe not on everything, but a country that has kind of like modest majorities in favor of a number of issue stances and kind of progress that they would like to see. It's just a matter of our government being able to reflect that. So I think, like, in contrast with other points in time when the country was really truly deeply divided, I think there are actually areas where we're less divided than it might appear.
Julia, we'll leave it there. Thanks again for joining us today.
Thank you so much. Thanks to the callers for great questions.
That's Julia Azari, Associate Professor of Political Science at Marquette University. She talked to us about why American democracy may have become fractured and, as we just heard, some signs of hope for our system. Maybe that things will get better as we get through it all. Always time for you to share your thoughts on these conversations. You can tweet us at Central Time WPR or email us a note, ideas@WPR.org. Remember, follow Great Conversations each and every day here on the radio, of course. Stream us online at WPR.org. You can check out the Ideas Network stream there or download the Wisconsin Public Radio app to your smartphone or comparable device. Coming up tomorrow on The Morning Show with Kate Archer Kent, doctors are changing the way they talk about weight and obesity with their patients. Find out why and join in with your own thoughts on the topic, maybe your own experiences as a healthcare provider or patient yourself. That's tomorrow morning at 7:30 here on the Ideas Network. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Barrett. Coming up, a Wisconsin veterans home is under review over concerns about the quality of care. We'll hear from the reporters who broke that story. Now it's muskie season across Wisconsin. Last weekend was opening weekend for the state's northern region. The season's been open in southern Wisconsin since early last month. The official state fish has a reputation for being hard to catch, but our next guest says the odds for anglers may actually be getting better. Zach Lawson is a fisheries biologist for the Wisconsin Department of Natural Resources. Zach, thanks for joining us.
You bet. Absolutely. Thanks for having me.
So some people might be intimidated by their chances of catching a muskie. What's your case for going out now that the season is upon us around the state?
Well, right now is a pretty good time to get out and start hunting for muskies. We've got most populations throughout the Northwoods have kind of wrapped up their spawn and a lot of those fish have recovered from spawning and now are in their post-spawn feeding pattern, if you will. And that makes a lot of those fish in very shallow areas and a lot more accessible to anglers. So it's a good time of year to get out there and try to hook up with a muskie.
Now, the muskie fisher folk out there know all about them. But for everybody else, can you give us a little muskie 101? Describe them, tell us about them, and why people love to fish for them.
Well, muskie, they have quite an allure about them. They're, they're fabled as kind of the fish of 10,000 casts, and they're this big, predatory, toothy, mean critter that's in very low densities in a lot of our lakes and rivers in Wisconsin, and so just not being able to run into them very often historically, they kind of just have this mystique about them. And so to even see a muskie, is quite a thing. But nowadays, as angling has become a little bit better for them in terms of catch rates and the amount of quote unquote action anglers might see, it's just a ton of fun is the only way to really to put it. So once you hook up with a muskie, you'll never forget it. And you'll just want to keep doing it more and more and more.
Now, I saw a picture of you a few years back with a muskie that looked like you could get a pretty good workout bench pressing that guy.
Oh, that's right. Yep. Obviously, musky anglers try to very frequently go after the largest individuals that they can find, and so it can be a real tussle when you tangle with one.
Well, what do we know about how the musky population is doing statewide?
Well, as I just mentioned, you know, musky fishing previously used to be a sort of thing where you might go weeks or months without even seeing a fish. And these fish naturally occur in really low densities in our systems. But in the course of, say, maybe the late 70s and in 1980s and 1990s, a lot of musky anglers started adopting this catch and release ethic, and through that effort and through learning a lot, as you know, through management agency and as research continued to build, we learned a lot more about how to better manage these species and fisheries. Then through the course of time, nowadays we find ourselves in really the good old days of musky fishing. And so, really in starting in maybe the 2000s to present day, we've noticed in a lot of our survey work that, you know, muskies are more prevalent on the landscape than they used to be. And angler catch rates have really, increased. So it takes a lot less time for anglers to go out and successfully catch a muskie. And so our fisheries, you know, for the most part in northern Wisconsin are in fantastic shape and some of the best, you know, providing some of the best fisheries that they ever have. So things look good for anglers out there.
And briefly, what do first timers need to know about the rules as far as when, how, and what to catch, when to catch and release?
Well, anglers should definitely be aware of the size limits, size and bag limits. So kind of the blanketed regulation is a 40-inch minimum length limit and a one fish daily bag limit. But there are muskies being a trophy species. There are a lot of special regulations out there. You'll see in some areas, for example, a 50-inch minimum on some lakes. And then you'll see in a lot of our action waters, quote unquote action waters, where they're at higher densities, you'll see, for example, a 28-inch minimum. So you need to be aware of the specific water body that you're on and what the harvest the size limit is for that respective water body. And other than that, you don't need to be aware of when the season is open. Obviously, you just mentioned that musky season just opened last weekend. And we'll go in northern Wisconsin until the end of the calendar year, so the end of December, through open water only. So good to pick up a regulations packet and comb through things for where you're going to be fishing to know exactly. But those are the major regulations to kind of sidebar with.
And in just our last half a minute or so, Zach, I understand Wisconsin maybe set some world records when it comes to muskies.
That is true. That is very true. Yep. Well, back in the day, currently the current world record is definitely, you know, came from Wisconsin. And, you know, the next world record might be swimming out there. We've got a lot of systems like Green Bay that are pumping out a lot of big fish. And so no doubt there could be the next world record swimming around right now.
Zach, thanks a lot for sharing this with us today.
You bet. Thanks for having me.
That was Zach Lawson. He's a fisheries biologist for Wisconsin's Department of Natural Resources. He was with us today to talk about the beginning of muskie season in Wisconsin and how the muskie population is doing across the state. If you happen to catch that world record muskie, let us know about it. We'll talk to you. Email ideas@WPR.org. Right now it's time for Wisconsin Life. Here's producer Maureen McCollum with a story of a food tradition from a Caribbean island.
Cooking can transport us to another place, another time. When we cook, we're able to keep our family's dishes and memories alive for generation after generation. That's the case for Anne Marie Herman in Madison, who was raised on the island of St. Lucia. WPR's L. Malik Anderson brings us her story about fish cakes. It's part of the Wisconsin Life series, Food Traditions.
The smell of hot oil, jerk chicken, and freshly baked bread with coconut and chocolate chips fill Anne Marie Herman's kitchen in Madison. She heats up the oil in a large, heavy cast iron pan over her stovetop. Her ingredients wait on the countertop, ready to be put to work.
This is flour. This is the codfish. It has thyme, onion, garlic, and other spices.
On the menu today, salted fish cakes. She fills the frying pan with as many batter fish cakes as she can at once. After they are all done, she takes them out of the pan and places them on top of a huge pile of more fish cakes. This dish has been a part of Herman's life for a long time.
I was born in the Caribbean islands, St. Lucia. But when I was much younger, I used to cook for my older brothers. That's how I started cooking, real cooking.
Herman grew up in the countryside with her mother and would go back and forth to the middle of the town to cook for her elder brothers who were taxi drivers.
My brothers were taxi drivers who were in the middle of town driving tourists and stuff, so they don't have time to do anything with cooking, so I used to do the cooking for them. But what my trick was, not using a lot of fat in my food. I didn't use to measure a lot of stuff when I was cooking.
Herman started keeping track of her measurements for each dish when she decided to publish a cookbook of family favorite recipes with a Caribbean twist.
You see inside of it? It has all the Caribbean islands in there. That's my idea of putting the Caribbean foods together.
In her cookbook, she shares recipes for beef patties, fried green plantains, aloha friendship bread. There's also jerk chicken and other dishes her family enjoys.
Fish cakes is another thing I make often. You take codfish, you boil it because it has a lot of sodium in it. So you wash it first, then you put it in a little pot to boil. And then when you give it a few minutes to cook, when it softens, you wash it again. You put more cold water on it to take the salt. Then you shred it and you add spices to it.
She said her fish cakes are always a hit among her friends in the Caribbean Association of Madison.
Sometimes I even try to hide it, but they find it before the meal. And some people will come and say, where is the fritters? They call it fritters. They ask me, where are the fritters you brought? It's there, but when you look, it's gone.
St. Lucia, island of the West.
WPR producer L. Malik Anderson brought us that story on Anne-Marie Herman's fish cakes. And this story is part of a project from Wisconsin Life called Food Traditions. It's a multimedia exploration of food, culture, and identity, and can be found at wisconsinlife.org/foodtraditions. Wisconsin Life is a co-production of Wisconsin Public Radio and PBS Wisconsin in partnership with the Wisconsin Humanities Council. Additional support comes from Lowell and Mary Peterson of Appleton. Want to make sure you catch every Wisconsin Life story? Subscribe to our podcast feed and find more Wisconsin Life at wisconsinlife.org and on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram. I'm Maureen McCollum.
Coming up, an investigation led by reporters at the Milwaukee Journal-Sentinel found that the Wisconsin State Veterans Home in Union Grove is among the worst in the nation when it comes to care violations. The reporters join us to share their findings. That's coming up next here on Central Time. This is Central Time on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Ferret. Now, reporters at the Milwaukee Journal-Sentinel investigated a veterans home in Racine County and found it has among the most violations and federal fines of all the Medicare and Medicaid-certified vets' homes in the country. Veterans' homes can be more affordable than regular care facilities and are intended to be a place where veterans can connect with each other about their experiences. But according to this Journal-Sentinel investigation, the state veterans' home at Union Grove is among the most troubled nursing homes in the state, ranking the top 10% for the most violations, with three times more violations than the average home. Daphne Chen is a data and investigations reporter for the Journal-Sentinel, and John Diedrich is an investigative reporter there. I talked to them earlier today about their reporting. First of all, John, what led the two of you to investigate Union Grove?
So we got some calls from family members who were concerned about the care of their loved ones, specifically Luann Krall, whose husband Randy died after a number of years of problems there, and her story is detailed in there. We also heard concern from a number of volunteers who were seeing substandard care. And so all those things led us to this investigation.
And Daphne, you looked into reported violations and fines at these kinds of facilities around the country. How did Union Grove in particular stack up?
Yeah, so we slice the data a couple different ways. And whether you look at the raw number of violations, whether you look at how many they had per inspection, or whether you even look at how many citations they had compared to the average in the state, this facility was always in the top 10, sometimes even higher, top two, top three. So we felt that, you know, it was worth writing about.
And Daphne, what kinds of violations and fines were most common among those?
They had violations for all sorts of things. A lot of it was medication mistakes, things like dehydration, even complaints of abuse allegations, which always get investigated.
John, you talked to many of the veterans there and their families. You mentioned Randy Krall's story. Can you share his story and what he experienced at Union Grove?
Yeah, so Randy was a Navy veteran, had diminished health in recent years, and they thought Union Grove would be a great place to go because they had they lived in the area. His wife, Luann, shares how there were problems really from the beginning. He had been there almost 4 years. There were problems in there with medication mistakes, with unexplained scratches, bumps, bruises, falling, things of this nature. In the end, the biggest thing that that came up, and this preceded Randy's death, was a case of dehydration. Daphne talked about that. This is the experts or the doctors in this case that were looking at his case. They estimated that he was at least 24 hours without liquids, he was rushed to the hospital. And they were not even able to get a urine sample from him. At the emergency room, he ended up returning to Union Grove, and he passed away not too long after that. There was a investigation into this, a complaint and investigation, they were fined for this for the dehydration issue, which had come up with other veterans as well, that they described how it's difficult just to get water there.
Daphne, a lot of operations, businesses, institutions of various kinds saw problems starting with the pandemic. As I understand your reporting, this started even before then. What did you see when it came to trends over time of complaints about violations at Union Grove?
Yeah, so our data goes back further than the pandemic. It starts in 2015. And for whatever reason, a lot of people said that they saw the light and care beginning around this time. A lot of nursing homes struggled with staffing. They struggled with infection control during the pandemic. But this predated that time period.
John, what do we know about what's going on? Why this is happening?
Well, there's been a real issue of short staffing. As Daphne mentioned, it's a problem throughout the country in this industry. But there is something different with Union Grove in the leadership. That's been a big red flag. So 5 leaders in 5 years, lots of turnover at that high level. And that's one of the things that the state has not been able to get a handle on. The Evers administration, they're the ones who oversee this. They're funded by federal dollars, but state veterans homes are overseen by the states. And this has been a struggle for the state to find a stable leadership there. And from what we hear, that really has hampered care, employee morale, a lot of issues with forced overtime. There has to be coverage, so with short staffing, but it goes beyond that with leadership turning over so often.
We're talking to John Diedrich and Daphne Chen from the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel, looking at the Union Grove Veterans Home, complaints about quality of care there, and possible solutions. Daphne, as we compare the kinds of violations you mentioned at Union Grove with others around the country, Union Grove stands out when it comes to numbers, as you were saying earlier. Does it seem like the more egregious problems, more serious problems, are more common at Union Grove compared to, again, the norm for these facilities?
I might have to punt this one to John. John?
Yeah, so in terms of the violations, we did see the most serious violation, the immediate jeopardy violation that was hit with Union Grove, and that was in the middle of the pandemic with failure to control the spread of COVID-19. Also abuse violations. There are also less serious violations. And as we look at other homes, specifically in Wisconsin, we see some of those serious violations as well, but the number, the sheer number, and when we look at the in terms of the serious, the federal government numbers this as far as seriousness, that Union Grove has more of those serious violations. To be sure, they have some less serious violations as well. But the ones that are really concerning to the regulators are, as Daphne mentioned, the abuse and this infection control issue that they had during the pandemic.
Now, John, you talked to various state officials, both in the Veterans Department, in the state legislature, and elsewhere. What kind of things are you hearing from them?
Well, from the State Department of Veterans Affairs, they oversee this series of three homes in Wisconsin. They laid out a whole series of efforts that they've been engaged in to try to hire and retain staff, to include a bump in pay, not a big one, but a bump in pay, some other steps to try to advertise and recruit. I mean, it's very similar to what other nursing homes are doing. They're trying to step that up at this point because it just seems as if they're in a situation where people are overworked and they're leaving and they just can't get people to come. And as they're short staffed, they just can't get people to fill in. As far as state lawmakers, Robin Voss and Senator, he's the Assembly Speaker, and Senator Van Wingard, they both represent this district. They're concerned. They've been talking to volunteers and family members as our reporting went on, and they expressed a lot of frustration that the situation hasn't changed. And, you know, what we're waiting for now is to hear from the governor and from others in leadership to be able to say, well, what can be done? And, you know, again, this is one of those situations where the federal government has the money that's going into it, but they don't oversee it, and the state oversees it. So it's a little bit of a tricky situation as far as oversight. And I think that's where there is a push across federal and state government to improve accountability and ultimately the care for these veterans.
And Daphne, as we move ahead, what are you watching for next on the story, or what kind of data are you hoping to find that might not be as readily available?
Yeah, we have lots of follow-ups planned. I mean, one thing that is interesting is that a lot of the data is actually still in the middle of being updated. So there are a couple more citations that are not in the federal data yet that we know have been issued against Union Grove. There are follow-ups regarding, you know, food was a huge issue that people mentioned. I think every person that John interviewed had mentioned the quality of the food there. And we're getting lots of tips about other nursing homes as well. So those will be some of the follow-ups.
We'll leave it there for now. Daphne, thanks for joining us today.
Thank you.
And John, thanks for being with us.
Thanks, Rob. Appreciate it.
Daphne Chen and John Diedrich are with the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel. They talked to us about their reporting on violations reported at the Wisconsin Veterans Home in Union Grove. Coming up tomorrow here on Central Time, supply chains are still out of whack, leading to alternating shortages and then sometimes oversupplies of some products. We'll sort out the supply chain, the long-term impact these problems could have, and what our guest calls the bullwhip effect. And a science fiction TV show that just had a 3-year run created a franchise that changed pop culture. Boldly explore the many lives of Star Trek with the author of the new book, Phasers on Stun. You can get us started right now. Are you now or have you ever been a Star Trek fan, original series, Next Generation, or some of the new crop of shows coming out to this very day? Let us know on the Ideas Network Facebook page. That's coming up tomorrow here on Central Time.